The Citadel Cafe is proudly sponsored by TweakedAudio.com. For high-performance, noise-reducing earbuds, visit TweakedAudio.com and use our code TCC at checkout for free shipping and 30% off your entire order. That's TweakedAudio.com.
This is the Citadel Cafe.
This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 132 for Wednesday, January 21st, 2015. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. We cover everything from movies and television to books, apps, websites. I'm not sure why I said websites. Websites. Stuff on the interweb.
There's something we don't know.
No, there isn't. Joining me tonight is that voice, Mr. John Beck. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. What have you been up to in this newly minted 2015?
Trying to get over the holidays.
You're still in recovery mode?
I am. I think I gained like eight pounds over the last month, and I'm just like, I need to make this stop. And it's cold, and it just like rained like freezing ice, so like everything's covered in ice like since yesterday or the day before, and I had to spend like half the afternoon looking for pet safe like ice melter, and I like went to like, I don't know, 10 stores, and like finally ended up at like a pet store that had them.
Wow. So
that was my afternoon adventure.
Did
I
you
had to drive like 40 minutes for that. Yay, living in the middle of nowhere.
Do you know which way that storm is heading? Because I might get that next.
No, I think I was looking at it. If it hasn't hit you, I don't think it's gonna. I mean, I think it was like the night before last. So.
Oh yeah, you're right. It probably would have gone through here. We get a lot of rain the other day, but nothing froze. This winter has been nuts. Like, I feel like we talk about weather on the Citadel Cafe a lot lately. I'm not sure why. But it was 2 degrees yesterday. I went for a run. It was nice.
Celsius or Fahrenheit?
Celsius. So okay. I'm not sure what that is. That would be 36, 30 something.
Yeah, that's nothing, dude.
Yeah. No, that's not cold at all.
Yeah.
Now, right now, it's probably close to minus 10 Fahrenheit.
Yeah,
it's about minus 15 right now in Celsius, which is bloody cold. Like, I mean, my fingers went numb today just walking a couple blocks in the city. I mean, I had gloves on, too. Like, just not a steady winter at all.
I think I want to say last week we were in negative 10 Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
That was freaking cold.
That's really cold. Yeah, Lou is telling us about that because Lou does not like the cold, not in the least. I was out today because I was at the Dalhousie University Farmers Market for the afternoon, which was it's not a huge market. It's only
like they still have a farmers market now.
We've got a farmers market here in the city that does gangbusters. It's a very cool space. Yeah, it's a brand new building down near Pier 21.
It's inside.
It's inside. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. No,
it's all the farmers markets being like stands in like little downtown areas.
Well, it's in the downtown. The big farmers market for the city is in the downtown area, but it's always been inside. It's always been in the for the longest time. It was in the old Keith's Brewery. Which is like circa 1870 something. But then they moved it to a new facility near Pier 21. And it's really cool. Like, it's got gray water system, and it's got a green roof and solar panels and windmills, and like, it's got a really kind of neat setup. But the Dalhousie Student Union has put on this farmer's market, for students, just because it's on campus. It's in the student union building. So it's kind of the hub for a lot of where people go. It's where the Tim Hortons is, you know, that kind of thing. So you get a lot of foot traffic. And they sell fresh vegetables and things like that.
You're making me hungry, dude.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But they also sell things like art. My friend Amber Solberg had been there for a few months, I want to say probably the fall term. She's now traveling, and she asked me if I wanted to take over the table that she had. So I said, yeah, sure. And I was in touch with the organizers, and I spent the day talking to students that were walking by about my comic work and illustration and stuff like that. And it was very, very cool. I had one person buy a book, And it looks like it's going to be a regular thing. I mean, I mentioned to you just before the show that I've kind of booked the Wednesdays off with the part-time gig that I've got. So it means that I'm going to be at the Dalhousie Student Union building every Wednesday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. selling books and doing sketches and stuff like that. So it should be cool.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. It's also given me a really good opportunity to finish off the new art book that I'm working on to publish this May. So normally I feel like I've just got so much going on that there's a lot of distraction at the home studio. So with nothing to do in the slow time when I'm out there sitting with, you know, nothing but my phone, you know, right. and a sketchbook, I can take the time to finish a couple of sketches for this new book, which is going to be a good way, I think, to be productive and also be out in the space.
I found, you know, especially, you know, working from home that at the very least, I have to get out. Like, if I don't get out, my productivity goes in the crapper.
Yeah.
And not to say that I'm productive when I'm out, but being, like, just having the escape and having the going and seeing people and being social and things like that. That to me, like, that keeps my brain, you know, when I get home, keeps me more motivated and all that sort of stuff. But I would imagine for you that having that time where it's like, I've got nothing else to do but do my work is, you know, like your work becomes, I'm going to pass the time this way. That must work out nicely for you.
Yeah, because it's a lot of time I'm trying to finish a sketch in an hour. So these are all, it's not a secret. The new art book is a brown paper sketchbook that I'm coming out with. And a lot of them are drawn from life, cartoons of people that I see in cafes and bars around town. But I sketch them while I'm there, and then I color them and ink them later. And I've scanned both versions in a lot of cases to kind of give people kind of like a process. The issue that I have is that I'm trying to set aside an hour every other day to work on this book, and with scheduling just an hour, I tend to try and race through the finished part of it as opposed to kind of enjoy it, and it becomes work. It's still work I enjoy, but it becomes like, okay, I've got to get this done so I can move on and do other things that are, you know, important. So it's nice when I've got, you know, an hour and a half or a little bit longer, or maybe not all at one time, because, you know, like, you know, a class gets out and there's a bunch of people to talk to as the students walk by, and then I can go back to drawing when it quiets down. So, which is nice too, because it's important, you know, I find, to kind of walk away from art from time to time, just like, yeah, you know what, I'm done coloring that right now. I'm going to wait until I ink it. I'll see, you know, what my brain thinks of it in, you know, a little while. And the markers that I use take a little while to dry, so sometimes the colors will change and I'll know whether or not I have to add more tone, stuff like that.
Right.
So, yeah. So far it's working out well. And something I liked today, and I'm hoping I'll see the results of in the future, was just speaking with people about Starcrossed. I always really enjoy talking with new people about webcomics, but after being at PodCamp this past Sunday, which is a local, I guess, communications convention. It's kind of an unconvention.
Yeah, I did a PodCamp back in Connecticut a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so same idea. We just call it PodCamp Halifax. In our beautiful new central library here in Halifax, which is a beautiful space, there's a lot of talking about just like being very personable with social media and marketing. And I mean, I tweet with the rest of them. My Facebook post. I'm getting a lot of interaction on Instagram lately, which is nice. But I feel like, you know, some old-fashioned word-of-mouth advertising will probably do me some good. So I handed out the last of my old flyers today. So I'm going to make some new ones and see if I can't circulate a few more in the coming weeks. And there's this great event that happens apparently on Wednesdays at the Student Union building, in that they give away free vegan lunch because there's a big vegan community on campus. And one of the local, I guess, vegan grocery stores just puts on kind of like a free sample sort of thing. There's a huge lineup of people just kind of standing there and staring
at my free vegan lunch.
Yeah. Standing there and staring at my table. Now, no one wants to leave their spot in line because it's a huge line, right? So next week, I'm going to be prepared. I'm just going to be like, hey, you look stranded. I'm just going to give you this. You can take this home. Throw it out. I don't care. Right. Whatever it is. But you're going to take my flyer, hopefully. And plus I think that people have seen me there now, they'll probably recognize me next week and stuff. It should be a good time. Be a good time. So is there anything, you know, are you just getting over the holidays? Anything new happening in your world?
Oh, nothing that I can actually talk about. So
okay,
as far as any work stuff, keep it secret.
The
work for me personally on my side projects is trying to get like I'm trying to get productive again, and it's difficult. And I've been slowly working on the iOS app version of Juxtaname, which we had talked about way back. But it's there, but you know, it's getting back in that mode is very difficult, and it's kind of hard because there's some stuff going on that sort of has me in a holding pattern. So it's kind of like just waiting on certain things. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, I don't know if I like, I need to just force myself to push through and do it. And it's hard.
Yeah. I've been noticing that for my work the last little while, is that with a few client things I have to wrap up. By the end of the month, I'm finding it difficult to justify time on things that I really should be spending time on, like the comic, and things that I promised myself, like I will focus on more this year,
right.
You know, like not so much as a New Year's resolution, but just like, as you know, I've mentioned several times, I've got a part-time job. Well, after Christmas, things are slow. Like there's not a lot of need for heavy hours. So I have the time. But my time seems to be filled up with other things. I'm not sure how my to-do
right.
list just never ends these days. I'm sure it's not an uncommon problem. You know, I've just like the other day, I had the entire day to myself to do whatever I wanted. The plan was to get a comic done, and I ended up dealing with email almost all day in a very good, I'm very thankful for it way, because it was all client stuff. It was like, hey, we set up a meeting next week, and hey, let's talk about this, and you know, let's set up a phone call this afternoon. I mean, that's all wonderful, but it meant that I didn't have time to do the comic.
Right.
So yeah, it's one of those things.
One of the things that I found useful. Have you ever read the book 18 Minutes? I don't know if we've ever talked about this.
I don't think we've talked about it. No, I've never actually heard of the book, so I'm guessing.
It's Peter Bregman is the author. 18 Minutes, Find Your Focus, Master Distraction, and Get the Right Things Done. So it's, you know, it's a getting things done thing, but the key phrase in there is get the right things done. And so it talks about like spending, you know, 18 minutes basically in your morning. And it has you sort of write out this grid of priorities,
mm-hmm.
of, you know, work, personal, things like that. And you just sort of put things in there at the beginning of the day, and it sort of helps you prioritize and divide up what you're working on. And then if you find that you're actually not doing it, get it off of there, that sort of stuff. Like if you're not getting it done, then it's not going to get done, and move on.
Right.
And so it was a really interesting take. I'm in the mode where like that could be helpful, but I can't even get like to that point right now. But when I am heavily productive and there's a lot going on, it's this kind of nice, like, you know, am I focusing on the things that matter to me? You know, like the things that are going to change my life in the next year kind of stuff. Like what's important to me? How am I working on my relationship with my wife? How am I working on, you know, my business? How am I working on myself? And writing things that are, you know, basically going, okay, what am I going to do today that is going to fit into those categories?
Mm.
And sort of making sure that I'm doing things that matter, you know, to the things that I've written down that matter to me, you know?
Yeah. And that, I mean, that brings me back to the talk about working on that new sketchbook project, and that it doesn't, I mean, I'm now no longer really sketching so much in cafes because I've got enough content, I feel, for the book. But when I was, it felt weird, you know, all through December and into January, taking, you know, an hour every other day to go to a cafe, grab a cup of coffee, sit down and sketch, which to me feels an awful lot like relaxing.
Right.
And then you feel guilty. And then you're like, no, I'm investing in myself. Like this is a project that will eventually be a book that I can sell, and you know, it'll get some social media, you know, buzz, hopefully, as I start to post some of the finished drawings, like a portfolio piece. Like there's all these things.
Yeah.
And it's weird because I've got a lot of content that I've produced over the last little while, but I haven't shown anybody because I kind of want the book to feel special. Like I've noticed the last little while over, you know, supporting some of my favorite artists is that because they're my favorite artists, I see their stuff online a lot. And then when I buy their books, I'm just like, hey, cool, it's in print. I've seen this already. I'm not disappointed because I get a very, you know, crisp, you know, in print is a very different feeling and different experience than just a digital picture.
But at that point, aren't you mostly just supporting them and thanking them for what you've gotten already?
Yeah, at some point, yeah. I mean, it does make it easier to reference it. Like, you're like, okay, I know exactly where and what page that drawing, you know, is as far as, you know, recalling it and taking a look at the technique versus finding out when in Tumblr they posted it. Like, you know, that right. It's a little easier that way. But
well,
that's
like the moment when you kind of figure out, like, you know, I stopped dealing with a lot with like social media at one point, because I walked into work one day. This was back when I you know, had my other job, and I was like, I can't. There's nothing to talk about. I've said it already. I've said it online. I've said it like I have nothing to say, because everyone already read that post, or everyone already like I feel like that's kind of like the personal version of, you know, the art book. I'm like, this, why am I putting this on paper if everyone's already seen it all?
Yeah. I mean, I see both sides of it. Cause I want to try to create a digital component to this book too.
Mm.
And so I don't want them to be, I mean, I want them to overlap, but I don't necessarily want them to be the same, because I want there to
be
value.
Right, you got
to
strike a balance there.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a difficult sort of thing as to where is the value going to be? And something that I find interesting, something that I heard at PodCamp repeatedly, and something that I've been hearing online as well, is that as digital as everything is, the paper book is not going away anytime soon. People still really appreciate, possibly now more than ever, unplugging and saying like, hey, if I leave my phone and my tablet, my computer in the other room and sit here with a cup of tea and a book, no one can reach me.
Tough that, like, for me though, like with web, with comics in general, but I would think with the web, you know, with like comic strips, I guess I've just never been like a consumer of comic strip. Like, let's put this, I'm a consumer. Like, I consume something and then I'm done with it. Like, you know, it's like, it's hard for me, like your, you know, not right now, I don't really have a coffee table, but I'm like, your book to me is a coffee table book. You know,
Oh, yeah, Starcrossed, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and because I read it all in the afternoon. And so, you know, it's like, it's one of those things that, you know, somebody else might pick up or, you know, and flip through here and there, but it's, you know, I like graphic novels, but I just rip through them and it's hard for me to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I want story and I want, you know, I want it faster, which is very strange. But it's, and I think it's, for me, maybe it's the way I process things, but because there's visuals, I process it so much faster.
Oh yeah. No, it's giving you a lot more information. You know, like, I mean, it sounds silly, but like, if you're reading a novel, you have to imagine what the character looks like, sounds like.
And I read the words in my head, you mm-hmm. know, like, because I can, you know, I learned how to speed read when I was a kid, and I can speed read, you know, which is great if you're like trying to get information in your head. But, you know, like, if you're actually trying to enjoy the words, I actually listen to the words in my head and say them, you know, say mm-hmm. them in my mind. And that forces me to slow down. It's harder to do that with a graphic novel or a comic.
I mean, and I noticed that too. I mean, I'll read comics by my favorite artists, like, say, like Scotty Young or the mm-hmm. guys at the Creature Box. I'll read one of their little comics and realize, like, I've read the whole page and I didn't look at any of the art.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you just, and
I
especially,
feel horrible at the end.
Yeah, like, I mean, Creature Box, these are guys that put a lot of time into making their stuff look just beautiful. But mm-hmm. ultimately, I mean, like, they're communicating an idea as quickly and as simply as they can in their own style, you know, and some people have right. more complex styles than others. Like, I hesitate to say, you know, stick figure comics, but like, say just a comic that is more efficiently drawn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I'm incredibly envious of artists that can draw their comic strip or comic book or graphic novel.
Well, because the idea takes precedent, you know, or takes
absolutely.
Priority
yeah.
versus the art of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there's a certain way you're communicating. I mean, like, if you're just doing a journal comic, then you don't necessarily need the same detail that a Batman comic would have. you know? Right. Like, I picked up the Batman New 52 series, like the first 20 or something, over Christmas on a Comixology sale. And I'm reading one a night just before I go to bed, just as a quick kind of 20-minute, you know, read 23 pages of comics and then go to sleep. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that I'm taking the time because there is some seriously cool artwork in that. I mean, it's shown off as Batman punches and kicks and flips and, you know, swings from buildings. But, you know, if you're dealing with something that's just, you know, a journal comic about somebody's life, or even just something that is a graphic novel, but not necessarily an action graphic novel, like maybe it's just a story.
Right.
Yeah, maybe like a drama. I don't necessarily pore over the art the same way that I would over a Batman comic. You know, like I kind of get, oh, okay, there's two people talking. One's a boy, one's a girl. Girl's got short hair. She looks sad. Like, you know, I don't,
right.
I get the idea that's communicated, but not anything else.
You don't take the time to really appreciate it.
Yeah. I find that I tend to go back maybe like, after I'm finished the page, I might kind of give a once over because my mind might say, the silhouette of that building looked really interesting, but I'm engrossed in the story. So I'll go back and look at that building when I'm done. Whereas when I'm reading Batman, I'll stop. Like, you know, he's punching somebody in the jaw and I'm going, wow, I think that's his tooth going flying. That's awesome. Like, you know, like right. Everything for me is just like, whoa. Like, I can feel it, you know, the artist just kind of takes over the fan, you know, like I right. get in there and I start dissecting stuff when I'm reading art that I like just as much, but is a bit more economic. I find that I just go back later, which is, it's an interesting kind of,
I guess it comes down to the purpose of it then, I guess, you know, it's like web comics are typically a short joke. You know, not all of them, but, you know, like, you know, this is a setup for a little bit of a punchline or something like that. And so it's, you know, you kind of, you want to get to the punchline. And some stories are so, or some, you know, some books are so atmospheric, like Batman or whatever, that the atmosphere is as integral and enthralling as the plot points.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. And I wish I could, I still may eventually draw a graphic novel, but that it would involve a lot more writing than I'm used to. And I think it'd be a great challenge. And I've done some long form stuff. Like I've worked for the Chronicle Herald here in town doing like features, which is not like incredibly long, but it's a lot longer than a comic strip. And I enjoyed it. It was a challenge. I liked branching out a little bit and telling a longer story. I have an immense amount of respect for the people that do it because it is a lot. I really want to say, as I don't want to slight any authors out there, but I really think it's harder than writing, you know, like a novel, doing a graphic novel. I think there's just a lot more to consider. Yeah. I mean, maybe not harder, maybe just, I feel like it's probably just a different kind of mindset. Like it's not, I don't necessarily think that a graphic novelist could just stop and just go write a novel, you know, or vice versa, you know, not without a lot of retraining the brain, if that makes sense.
I guess. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would say, well, and I think this probably happens more often. I mean, how often are, you know, most graphic novels aren't written by the same person who does the art?
I'm not sure where most would fall in there.
I guess
days, most of the stuff that I find are indie, so they tend to be written by the same people.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Interesting.
I mean, it's a different medium, so yeah. You should, you know, I think it's one of those things. I don't think one disqualifies you from the other, but having no experience in one or the other would obviously make it difficult.
Yeah, like I feel like I might have made a blanket statement there without meaning to. I just mean, like, if you've done nothing but write and draw graphic novels, and then you decide to, hey, I'm going to write a novel. I'm going to do like a, you know, a straight up.
I think, you know, descriptive, like I've always been very good, you know, with writing really vivid imagery descriptions of things. I usually end up spending probably too much time on that in the stuff that I write. But, you know, that's kind of where I excel in that particular area. So I think it's like you're right, there's different skills. I mean, there's skills in writing good dialogue, there's skills in writing, you know,
yeah,
it's everyone, you know, being able to, you know, have rhythm and meter in what you're writing and things like that. And it's definitely, I think what I'm getting out of what you're saying is there's a lot of nuanced skill in all forms of writing, and you know, yeah, one does not lead directly necessarily into the next.
That is a much better way of saying it than I muckled onto earlier. Yeah, I agree. what have you been watching when you're not, you know, thinking about writing and creating and doing and all these kind of things? Like when you sit down in the evening to just kind of like chill out, maybe with your wife, what have you been doing?
Yeah, so our evenings consist of my wife comes home, I've made dinner, we sit down, and then something comes on TV. And we watch like a lot of stuff. We watch like, and I watch more than her. And I think we kind of talked about this a little bit. I watch pretty much everything and anything. But all the shows that we watch are pretty much have been on hiatus for like the past month. Everything's like took the holiday break.
The mid-season break, yeah.
Yeah, and so nothing's been on, and so I think it's at whatever point a month and a half ago, Sandy started to go through the Gilmore Girls on Netflix, and ended up getting me roped into it. And so we just finished that last week or so or something like that, which is very interesting. I don't know. I'm sure a lot of people will hate on the Gilmore Girls. It's actually reasonably well-written dialogue-wise, very snappy. And it's funny for us to watch because it's about Connecticut. Like, it's about, like, everything about it is, like, where we're from.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see, like, you know, like they say stuff like the I-95, and I'm like, no one says the I-95, like weird stuff. Like, I'm like, the things they get wrong and things they get right or whatever. It's just funny. It's just weird having a show that is directly talking about the things and, you know, that you're used to seeing every day. And,
yeah. It's funny that you mentioned good dialogue earlier. I've always really enjoyed the Gilmore Girls for the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I realize it's kind of unrealistic.
So we're both coming out today as Gilmore Girls fans.
I don't know that I'm necessarily coming out today. I've mentioned it at least on one podcast before. I don't know whether it was this one, but I've certainly talked about Gilmore Girls on air at some point.
I don't know what it is, but I feel like there should be shame involved in it. And I don't know. It gets a fair, maybe it's like all the horrible Family Guy references that rag on it all the time or whatever. But I don't know. I feel like we deserve shame. But we watched it and actually reasonably ended. Like, it was a series that had I was satisfied with the end of the series. I was like, okay, this came to a close. Thank you. I'm glad that, you know, some writers actually get to tie up, not necessarily in a neat little bow, but actually tie up the threads that they've got out there.
Yeah, I've only watched it the once through, because it's something massive, like 7 seasons, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
6 or 7.
So I don't have the whole thing memorized, but I feel like I enjoyed certain seasons more than others, as you do with mm-hmm. most shows. The thing that I found with it, because I had access to it, I think it was via DVD. I was sick or something like that, and I just kind of needed something to not have to think about. Just like, you know, I just have to hit next, you know, and keep watching. Yep. With dramas like this, especially, I want to say teen dramas, but stuff that's kind of this genre, mm-hmm. You tend to notice the bad decisions being made by people over and over again. Because you're yep. watching everything in succession. It's not been 6 or 8 weeks of this story. It's been 6 hours. You're yep. just like, how do you not remember what happened like 6 hours ago? Why are you still talking to this guy?
Like, well, and they also, they always, like, you know, they always reflect Loreline and Rory, the mother and daughter, always, like, they are always making the same stupid mistakes at the same time.
Like, yeah.
Like, it's so true. Okay, come on. Like, And what gets me is it takes me out of it, because it becomes less of a personal choice of the character and more of a, this is a writing choice. Like, they're writing about this now, and this is happening to both of the women. So it's which I, you know, I guess you don't really want to deal with, you know, the you know, you don't want to, like, you know, people are going to make similar mistakes and have those things that they're not, you know, they're probably not going to be happening at the same time, but you don't really want to retread the same water on a show.
Yeah.
So if they're going to do it, they might as well happen on the same episode.
Yeah. I remember watching one of the DVD extras that they had, and I feel like the average hour-long drama was something between 45 and 50 pages of dialogue for the actors, and this and Gilmore Girls averaged something like 60 or 65.
Yeah, it's usually a page a minute.
Yeah.
And yeah, they cram a lot. It's very fast. I mean, it's and that's one of the reasons, I mean, you know, that's why I always liked you know, like West Wing and things like that, you know. And I love Aaron Sorkin, I love David Mamet. Anything with really fast, snappy dialogue where you're kind of like your brain is just wholly engaged in just even listening and comprehending what they're saying half the time.
Yeah, it's the kind of show that you can't do something else. Like, you can't browse Twitter and watch the show. Like, you kind of, you have to be 100% focused.
Yeah, well, at least, yeah. At least when words are involved, yeah.
Yeah, true. Yeah, yeah. The walk and talk, you know?
Yeah, you can't, you know, like, Sandy and I basically sit there and, you know, knit, you know, and watch TV. And that's a very meditative thing. And so it's like, you know, the brain can hear. I don't see it half the time. But that's a show you don't really have to see all that much.
Mm.
That's, you know,
true.
It's a lot. It's mostly, you know, it's a lot of verbal.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can look up every now and then, but
yeah,
I'm certainly not a good enough knitter to sit there and actually, like, not look at my knitting.
Yeah, but very dialogue heavy. That leads me to my next question. I was going to ask you if you were knitting, but you answered it for me. So when did you start knitting?
Years ago.
No
but
kidding.
Very, very off and on. Like last year, last winter, I made a sock. A sock, and then I got second sock syndrome. And
so this winter it's the start. the other sock.
I finally did the other sock and made a second pair.
Yeah.
So and now I'm moving on to I solved my issue, which is the way you solve second sock syndrome is you knit them at the same time. So I'm doing what's called the magic loop method, which is circular needles and literally the two socks are on it. So you do one side of each sock and then turn it and do the other side of each sock.
Okay. Yeah. I've seen, around and around. I think I saw my grandmother do that one time.
Yeah, so I'm working on, I've got some nice, sort of silky yarn that I'm knitting up, much, you know, like actual sock weight yarn. I did like chunky stuff. So really, you know, like wool socks before, and now I'm doing things where it's like, I don't know, 70 stitches per row for each sock.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, this is take me forever.
Yeah, I like wool socks. They lately, I've had a great use for them.
Yeah, for, like, they're nice to run the house. I can't wear them in shoes, though, because my feet need to breathe.
Like, yeah, well, that's the issue, that I've been working from home for so long and I've had to commute a lot this winter that I don't really have proper winter boots that aren't like knee-high shovel snow winter boots. Like, not necessarily things.
Right.
There's no snow around. It's just really freaking cold.
Right.
And what I've been wearing is running shoes, which is, they're perfect for summer and they breathe, yep, but they're not warm at all for winter.
Right.
So I just bring a pair of wool socks in my backpack, and I mean, I take them off when I get where I'm going, but for being outside, you know, waiting for a bus, it's nice to have the wool socks on. I appreciate them.
Oh yeah, they're great.
At that juncture. But
I just don't go anywhere. I literally don't go anywhere. There's no reason to go anywhere except if I have to go shopping, which is like maximum once a week to go get groceries.
Wow.
And that's probably more than I should go. But, you know,
yeah,
yay, living in the sticks.
Yeah, I grocery shop a couple times a week, but I buy little loads because I'm often carrying it around.
You're also shopping for, you know, one.
Yeah, that's true. That's
in worst case, you've shopped for two. I mean, I guess I'm, you know, I'm shopping for two, but sort of.
Well, you've
like,
you've got pets, or at least one pet, right?
Well, yeah, but we don't really. I mean, that, you know, every 6 months I buy a giant bag. I mean, that's
that's it, right?
Yeah, and they don't like, and Pang doesn't eat the same food as the other dogs in the house, so his food is separate.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
But,
right on. I had some nice surprises this week for what I've been watching. I watched Noah, which I saw a preview for in theaters, and I was like, nope, not happening. I am not going to go see that. Just because it looked like every other Russell Crowe period piece that you've ever seen in a preview. But it was on Netflix. And I thought, well, it's late on Saturday. I need something to watch before I go to bed.
And I would like to tell you, I watched it because of you.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Oh, sweet. So we can actually have a dialogue on this. Yeah. This doesn't always happen. You know, like with both people, you know, having watched the same film.
I could do this. Let's do this.
Yeah. Well, because you'll watch anything
else on. There's nothing else on.
We had the same mentality, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So did you like it?
It was weird. It was definitely not what I expected at first. And I don't know why I didn't expect it, because we're talking Darren Aronofsky, like, we're weird, crazy ass director. And I don't know why I didn't expect what was happening, but it's basically a fantasy, borderline sci-fi epic, like set in the parable of Noah. Like,
yeah, I was
furthest thing removed from anything biblical.
Yeah, which I appreciated. Like, I kind of went in there kind of going, I don't know exactly what to expect. And as with most situations for movies like this, if you have very low expectations, they tend to surprise you.
Yeah.
So I thought it was good acting, you know, Russell Crowe, Jennifer Connelly, Emma Watson, Hopkins, like they're all talented actors. They weren't given horrible lines. I enjoyed the moral dilemma that Russell Crowe, that Noah had to deal with. You know, I thought it was pretty good. The story wasn't really preachy either. There wasn't even a mention of God. They called him the creator all the time.
Yeah, I mean, on his moral choice, I felt it was interesting that there was no good guy in this movie. Like,
yeah.
You really, it's like you can look at this either he's insane or he's doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, whichever way you fall, it kind of tears you up inside a little bit. So I thought that was kind of cool that there wasn't a straight up, like, Noah's not a hero in this at all.
No. I mean, there's a large part of the third act where you really dislike the guy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I thought that was interesting. Like, and so character arcs like that are what kind of kept me on board. Like, it shocked me. I just didn't say it shocked me. It gave me enough of a surprise when I first got into it that I thought, okay, I'm curious to see how it's going to pan out. Like, I want to know how this story is going to be handled. Mm. I mean, some things were handled better than others. Some special effects were fantastic. They mentioned
most of that you're talking about, like the stuff that was blended with the other stuff, you know, like the
fallen angels that were all like kind of encrusted with earth. They had like multiple limbs. Basically, it was like they were like multi-limbed bats. That's how they kind of walked. Like their wings kind of stuck on the ground as if they were sticky. Like, but they looked. They kind of. I know. I just from being an animator, like watching them move, I know that they were trying to make the CG look like stop motion. Like it was very reminiscent of the old Ray Harryhausen Clash of the Titans stuff.
Usually what happens to me when I finish a movie and I'm like, I don't know what I think about this. Like if I'm really kind of like on the fence about everything, I usually start looking at different reviews just to like get some language. I'm like, what am I missing here? Mm. And one of the first things I came across on a review was that they're Transformers. And they kind of are, like, they move like Transformers, like they're like it's a little weird.
They do kind of spin around a lot, don't they? Like kind of twist in places where you didn't think they would be able to have like a limb or a joint.
I actually they're one of my more enjoyable parts of the movie. And the moment where they start to realize that they can go to heaven was like almost made me cry. I was like, that was like a really touching, poignant thing. And it was entirely these CG characters.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I thought that was a really poignant, I guess, moment in the film when that started to happen. Because like they weren't expecting it. Like they were just basically willing to die to see Noah's cause through.
Yeah, I mean, they thought the creator had completely left them and given up on them, and that they were exiled to this horrible existence. Yeah. And then the horribleness of them all, you know, sort of once they all realize, and they start going off like crazy.
The thing that I found really transparent about the whole plot was just the, I felt like it was an attack on carnivores. Like all the bad guys, like the only real thing that separated Noah from everybody else was that they ate meat. Like that seemed to be the big thing is that they ate meat, and that was what, you know, made them, you know, well, I mean, they cut down trees and they, you know, basically they abused the land around them. It was kind of like one part environmental film and one part like, huh, you're not a vegetarian, huh?
I think that speaks to one of the weaknesses of the first act, which is we don't really truly see the savagery of man until the second act.
Mm.
And I think that was a big failure. It doesn't set them up as really horribly bad.
Yeah.
And in the second act, we see things I didn't really want to see. And in fact, I had actually briefly fallen asleep and, you know, Sandy like gasped and I woke up to like, you know, them like eating the children and like all these horrible things. Like,
yeah,
it was, and I'm like, why didn't that come sooner? Like it from that point on, that's when the movie got me. Once I was like, I felt I could root for somebody. There was nothing like it. There was no conflict up until that point. It didn't feel like there wasn't, you know, it was all just Deus Ex Machina over and over again.
Yeah. You didn't really have a face like the bad guy. And by that, I mean like all of the other people, the men,
right.
Or man, I guess they didn't have, the same sort of clout that say like classic villains, like, you know, Darth Vader and, the Empire has,
right.
Like,
introduction, you get it.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And they didn't feel threatened. You don't even really know what they are outside of like a very quick kind of prologue as to who begat who and who killed who and who the descendants were,
right.
And what that means. And I mean, I find it interesting that it's not necessarily magic. It's more just like this spiritual powers that some people have, some people don't have. That kind of stuff was interesting. The other CG that takes me right out of it was, I think it was the part where they cut to like the snake in the Garden of Eden and the forbidden fruit. That's
the storytelling part.
Yeah, like there's just no excuse to have stuff that looks like that in film these days.
I think I will defend this in that it was stylized. I didn't see it as bad CGI. It was all very like it was a lot of the sort of sometimes two-dimensional like projected on a screen sort of like it was very stylized and it was a very much a dream sequence type thing. It wasn't meant to be realistic.
Yeah, but if you're gonna go that way, you've got to go really far. Like you've got to do like, I mean, I can appreciate like a flat kind of say like a cave painting kind of moving around. I'm remembering Ice Age did that, I think, in one of their films, but it was like a crayon drawing moving on a cave wall versus the CG, you know, you can see a million hairs on the mammoth, you know, film. And there was a huge difference between those two different styles. So there was no confusion. And it's not like I was confused between the story sequences and the real life stuff. But I felt that it was close enough that I wasn't sure what the intention was. It was like, did they try to make this look real and fail, or were they trying to be stylistic and also fail? So it pulled me. It reminded me that I was watching a movie and not engrossed in a story. I think is my issue with it.
What did you think of the creation of the world sequence?
Oh, that was later on, wasn't it?
It was. He tells the story.
Tells
again.
The story.
I mean, they you know, because those are actually bits and pieces of it, and then they kind of do the whole thing in the middle.
Yeah, it was like first there was nothing, and then there was like the first day and the second day. Yeah, I mean that kind of stuff was okay, because that again was very stop motion like. It almost looked like time lapse photography.
Right. They did a lot of very fast cuts.
Yeah.
I found it like. In terms of what it was meant to do, like I actually thought it was pretty cool, because I've always been like, I'm a fairly spiritual person. I'm not a religious person.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't necessarily say that I believe in God, but I believe in energy and the universe, and there's something, you know, there's some connectivity that I believe in. And I've never quite understood why you know, religion can't make room for evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know the technicality of why, but I, you know, I'm like, and this kind of hit that middle ground perfectly for me. If, you know, it was very much like the idea of this creator guiding evolution.
Well, yeah, and that's kind of how I, you know, they were explaining how the creator made the universe and made the planets, and the visuals that they were like, the what was being spoken by Noah was very, felt very biblical. Whether or not they were quoting or not, I don't know. I don't know verse that well.
Yeah, it was fairly, it was definitely different, but similar.
Similar, yeah. Hitting the same milestones anyway, you know, first day, second day, all that kind of stuff. But then the visuals were what I recall seeing when I was watching Cosmos.
Right.
You know, and watching the science show about how physics and just gravity and everything just kind of made stuff happen. Yeah. I thought it was an interesting kind of bridge. It felt like a hybrid.
Yeah.
Because of the visuals with the words along with it. It was interesting. And again, I really appreciated the non-preachy nature of the film. Like, I didn't at all feel like it was encroaching on anyone's beliefs. Like,
well,
I
think it was an interesting exercise, basically.
Yeah.
Someone, you know, they took it and they said, okay, this, let's treat this. It's like if an alien read the parable of Noah, you know, and interpreted it. You know, someone who's not connected to the Bible, not connected to, you know, it's this thing of this completely different world. And I thought that was kind of cool in concept. I think overall it was just, there was definitely some weirdness and some disjointedness to it. And I was kind of left by the end of it, kind of like, I don't know, like the ending kind of weirded me out. Like it just, it still left me. I kept going back and forth on like, I kind of like this, I kind of don't like this, and then ended up completely in the middle by the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think because I didn't dislike it, I also can't say that I'm, you know, recommending it to people. You know, like you said, it was an interesting exercise. It was a neat to see how that kind of thing was handled. There's a lot of stuff that I feel really wasn't a good fit just for me personally. Like, I mean, this is silly. For whatever reason, Skeletor, I mean, Jennifer Connelly, she just freaks me out now. There's something about her that
is
just,
I don't get that.
She's just dead inside.
Is it a thing to call her Skeletor?
No,
now?
I'm just making a bad joke. No, I feel like whenever I see her on film now, she just looks frail. She looks, not just physically. Like, I don't mean just her. I mean, like, whenever I see her acting, she just feels like everything is just draining out of her soul. It's just, it's hard to watch.
Yeah, I felt like the acting was a little over the top at times. And then I realized, well, this whole thing is over the top. Like,
yeah.
This is like really out there. But I think, you know, I think what says it all, if you can boil this down to one word, it was what my wife Sandy said at the end of it. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was it. Like it was, I didn't pay to see it in the theater.
And no.
I don't think anyone really should have. Like, I would have been a little bit like, what the crap did I just pay to see?
Yeah, I would have been really disappointed had I paid to see it in the theaters. But, on Netflix, it's fine. I have a hard time walking away from movies, whether they suck or not. Like, I tend to see them through. There's always that notion that maybe it gets better. This got better than my, like you said, at the end of the first act, you're like, okay, I'm curious, but I'm not necessarily engaged. And so that's kind of when I went to bed, and then I finished it the next day in another sitting, which to me is a sign of a movie that I'm not super thrilled
by. So you basically went to bed when I probably fell asleep in the movie.
probably around the same time. Yeah. Because, like, I mean, I tend to watch Netflix stuff with meals, and I try to stick to television content because then I can watch, you know, about an hour while I eat. I have another half an hour, 20 minutes to relax, and then I go back to work just kind of as an escape. But if I watch a movie, in particular a good movie, my 1 hour lunch break or 1 hour, you know, a dinner break turns into 2 to 2.5 by the time I make dinner, sit down and eat it. If it's a good movie, because then I don't want to, I won't turn it off. You know, like
Your goal is to find horrible movies to watch on your lunch.
Or just stick to good TV shows, at which point I can like, nope, I can walk away from this.
See, my problem is always the TV show. Oh, just one more episode.
Yeah.
Like, there is... oh, I got to really find out. Like, you know, Gilmore Girls always had that, like, leave it on a cliffhanger thing. Like, you bastard.
Well, at least with that, though, you're dealing with, like, 45 minutes. So even if you watch two... you're still coming in like under a DreamWorks feature, you know, like it's still under 90 minutes.
Just a
little bit of a clip. Yeah. Well, I can move on, I guess, into what we've been reading, because I've been wanting to mention this since we started talking about comics and art books at the beginning of the show. And I've had kind of this battle going on inside me, and I need to find another artist or two that have received this book as well to talk about it. And that is the Masters of Anatomy. I'm pretty sure I mentioned it on the Citadel Cafe at some point. You can go to mastersofanatomy.com and check out what the book is. It raised $500,000 on Kickstarter over a year ago, to make this book about this classic, the classic Loomis kind of, you know, ideal pose, man, woman, you know, front, three-quarter side. They're not necessarily supposed to be supermodels. They're more just kind of like the average, but also the average aesthetic. And it was supposed to be about proportion, anatomy, and all that kind of stuff. And so I ordered the book. I helped them out on Kickstarter. It was an $85 hardcover book. It's a thick book. It's a large piece of kit. And of course, here where I am in Canada, I'm gonna guess that between 35 and 45 of that 85 was shipping, because it was FedEx or something. Like, I mean, it had to be a lot of money. But I wanted to support the project because I thought it was a very cool opportunity. Especially because
the website looks interesting.
The website is fantastic. And this is where I want to caution people, is that the website is a little bit misleading. The poses in the books are very simple. They're very just kind of like a person or a man and a woman standing in three different angles. So there's a profile, there's a front on, and then there's a three quarter. Sometimes the artists have been a little bit more creative in that maybe a guy has got all of his weight on one foot and he's leaning, or he's up on one toe, that sort of thing. Same thing with the girls. Sometime there was one comic book artist that drew the female floating, with her arms a little bit out more, as if it was like, say, like Phoenix from X-Men or something like that, just in terms of to get something a little bit different in there. But I, you know, I mentioned that I was surprisingly pleased with Noah. I was surprisingly disappointed with Masters of Anatomy, and I'm only halfway through, so I can't kind of drop the hammer on it, and I'm going to be very careful not to be too subjective with this stuff. But you know, you're talking about blowing through books really quickly. I sat down in a matter of 15 minutes and I got halfway through this book. And it was just page after page after page of the same kind of artist doing the same non-anatomy drawings. There's a big foreword that I read at the beginning about style and aesthetics and all that kind of stuff. And while I appreciated, I didn't really realize quite exactly what they were trying to do until I got halfway through the book. And now in hindsight, I really kind of feel like they know that it wasn't as strong as they had originally kind of set it. Like, their thesis did not really get proven in terms of putting this book together. There's a lot of very cartoony drawings, which is fine. I'm a cartoony cartoonist. I mean, when you look at Starcrossed, I am not drawing anatomy. In proportions, you know, like I'm trying to get
there's
some
the head
things.
It's a circle.
Yeah, I'm trying to get some things right, but I'm not at all trying to figure out where femurs attach to kneecaps and you know, spine proportions and stuff like that. For example, Charlie, my main character, is probably more like 5 heads tall as opposed to 8. That kind of stuff. And there's a lot of that kind of thing in this book, but it's a lot of the same. There's a lot of very tubular drawings, and I don't mean this in the Ninja Turtle kind of cowabunga way. I mean, there's no anatomy. When you draw two lines between shoulder and wrist, and they're straight, like, there's no anatomy there. And I'm thinking, okay, sure, pick an artist that does that, use that as an example. That's a very minimalist look at anatomy. Agreed. You know, like, I can't really refute that. But when you fill a book with it, a book that I paid almost $100 for, I start to feel a little bit jaded about it. That's not to say that there aren't some fantastic pieces in there. Herrera did a great, great piece. His example was the one that I mentioned where like the guy is very muscular and he's kind of standing off balance. Like he's doing like a contrapposto kind of pose. And there's a lot of anatomy information. Like he's not drawing the guy without his skin on. And he's not a bodybuilder either. He's just got this, it's Herrera's style and it looks great. But yeah, it didn't really deliver on what I was led to believe. And I think a part of that is due to their marketing. It got such a huge following. It's a Canadian project. It was printed in Canada, so they kept it local in terms of, you know, nationally, which is another reason why it probably costs so much. But the website where they listed all of the artists that they paid to contribute to the book is amazing. Like, if you go to Masters of Anatomy and you look at the artists that they've selected, and any of those artists that you pick on, like almost any of them, you will be blown away by the work that they display on the Masters of Anatomy website, saying, hey, here's a few samples of Herrera's work, of this other artist, Campbell. And it's phenomenal. And then they put them in these poses and they ask them to submit these drawings. And it's like all life and all anatomy was just vanished from the poses. Like even some of the big names that I admire a lot and follow their work online, I was disappointed. It's better than some of the other work in the book, but it's by no means what I was expecting. You know, I find I see more anatomy in the Masters of Anatomy website than I do in their book. And I feel like as I keep on talking about it, I'm coming down harder and harder on it. And I want to talk to other artists about this that have also purchased the book. And I'm wondering if I had the reverse experience with this book that I did with Noah, in that I had very high expectations going into this project. I felt very proud to have backed the project on Kickstarter and been a part of helping them make, you know, the book a reality. And now that I have it, I'm kind of wondering, that experience.
It sounds
has
like
been...
it wasn't very well project managed, basically. Like,
yeah, it's. And again,
here, send an email to this artist, please submit a thing with these criteria, and then they just shoved him in a book.
Yeah, and there's a couple of misprints. Like I did a double take a couple times where they've printed the same artist twice in a row. Like it's the same two pages. That sort of thing. Well, I mean, that could also be a printer error. Like that might have nothing to do with the people that actually produced the book. That could be a printer, you know, two pages sticking together at the printer. It might be just my copy for all I know. Right. Or it could be, you know, a couple hundred out of the, I don't know how many thousands of these books that they sold. Right. But yeah, it's disappointing so far. I'm hoping that maybe they put some of the better ones at the back of the book. I'll let people know. I was really excited though. Like I even made an unboxing video, talking about the book and telling people where they can find it. And I'm just like now, and I haven't put that out there yet because I'm kind of wondering now if I'm going to have a, a reboxing video where I say, this is just going to go on the shelf. It was fun, you know, for the 20 minutes I looked at it, but I'm not sure how often I'm going to,
how do you think this compares? I mean, they, on their website, they talk about what's wrong with the anatomy book, you know, like what's wrong with a typical anatomy book in that it there's only ever a couple of useful things out of it or something like that. 'Cause you're only getting one person's style. So their whole idea was let's get a bunch of different artists doing different style, doing the same anatomy. And so you're saying it seemed like everything was still this basically the same style.
It's not that everything was the same style. It's that there is a consistent lack of anatomy.
Okay. So they're not drawing very detailed anatomy.
No. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. Like it's the kind of drawings that I bet if you looked at these artists and looked at their characters fully clothed, there's probably motion, detail, weight, and all of it is going to be in the clothing. Underneath, the structure that these artists are using are essentially just like tube connectors.
Wow.
And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing because I use that all the time. Like when I draw Charlie,
That's not what the book is supposed
to be. When I draw Charlie in a colored shirt, like I draw the shoulder, the elbow, and the wrist as a tube with a joint in the middle, because that's all the information I need. And then I drape the shirt over that. And that is what, you know, kind of gives Charlie his look, his how he's moving. If he's moving really fast in one direction, the shirt is going to be kind of trailing behind him in the other. And without that clothing, a large part of the artists whose work you can see on mastersofanatomy.com that looks amazing, when you strip away the clothing and get down to the bare bones of it, it's really just bare bones. Like there's there's nothing there. And I think another issue that I might have, and another not misguided view, but just a perspective that I don't have, is that of the 14 to 18 year old artist, and whether or not this would be an amazing book for them. I mean, me
right.
coming
yeah, that,
into
that
it.
That was the other question I was going to ask you. Who is this for?
Well, they
value out of this.
Yeah.
Not who do they advertise it for? Who do you think will find value out of the book?
Yeah, and I'm still trying to come down on that. Like I'm still trying to figure out what would be my recommendation. So like I don't know whether I'm going to say no, the book is not very good, don't spend your money on it. I might say, if you're a professional, if you've got 10 or 12 years, you know, illustrating as I do, this isn't the book for you. However,
right.
this might be the book for your 10-year-old or your 14-year-old. I mean, there's some nudity in it, so maybe, you know, slightly older where they're not, you know, giggling at this kind of stuff.
Right.
But where it's like, oh, okay, look, they're interested in drawing, they're interested in, you know, maybe taking a little bit more of a serious hobby at drawing, then this would be potentially a good book for them. But at the same time, because of the way that they talk about style at the beginning of the book, which is very advanced, I don't necessarily know that those concepts would be able to be grasped by people that are so young. And I feel like there might be some bad habits in terms of some people saying, oh, well, I don't have to learn anatomy. I can just draw tubes and I'll be okay. Right. And it's just like, no, that's not the right message. Like I kind of wish that the editors of the book had have been a little bit more kind of like, well, that's your style, but we need, it's called the Masters of Anatomy. Like we need a little bit more information than what you're giving us. And I, you know, and this is where it gets subjective. This is where it's like, well, if I was editing the book, blah, 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 blah. Like it just, you know,
and I
don't want to say it. Cause I mean, like how many books have I produced that are art books? None, zero, zilch, not happening. You know, like, so, you know, I don't want to sound a little bit too preachy having not done something like this before, having not done a Kickstarter that did $500,000 and understand what the kind of work that means as far as the logistics of like shipping and storing and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's just, it's one of those things that I feel very torn on at the moment. And, it's good to talk about. Like, I mean, even talking to you about it, like just cause I know of your appreciation for the arts and, you know, your ability to talk about it. I feel like it's a little bit more of a balanced kind of discussion. Whereas when I was talking to a buddy of mine, who's also an artist about it, and he's seen the book. We kind of had not a lot of time to talk about it, but it was a very matter-of-fact discussion, and it wasn't very positive. we were pretty hard on it, just kind of out of the gate. And I'm curious as to what my experience is going to be with the rest of it. But, I mean, if you're out there, dear listener, and you have a copy of Masters of Anatomy, drop me a line on Twitter, Joel Duggan, and let me know, because I'd like to talk to you about it and see what I might be missing, especially if you're a young artist, if you're up and coming, and you're learning, then I'd like to know whether you think this is great.
Yeah. I feel like I'd want to flip through this. Like, this is like one of those things, like if it's in a bookstore, I'd flip through it and then, you know, then at least I could decide not to do it. But, you know, I hear what you're saying. I need to see what you're saying.
Yeah. It's also not the greatest thing to, you know, podcast about, because it's a very visual,
right?
It's a very visual thing. You can, I mean, if you go to you can still find the Kickstarter page and watch the video and see what they're, you know, meaning and intending. And I think they eventually shared some sample pages because, at one point, I mean, they delivered late on it, which is fine, because as the Kickstarter went gangbusters, instead of adding more products, they basically just added more artists. So
okay.
you paid the one price for the book, and without ever having to increase what you paid for it, the book got thicker.
Hmm.
I mean, it's all black and white inside, so it really wasn't going to cost them a whole lot to add, you know, a few more artists. But what they were doing, say, hey, if we hit this stretch goal, we'll be able to afford to pay, like, you know, J. Scott Campbell or Herrera or a lot of these other people that, you know, were invited to draw on the book. But I've got there's another drawing book by Frank Cho that a friend of mine has recommended, and I'm wondering, if he's also got a copy of this, and I'd like to see if he's got both and compare notes, whether he thinks one is better than the other, or whether it's just like, you know, too much of the same, just written and explained in a different way. So there's no writing in this either. Like I would love to have the artist's notes on why they draw forearms the way that they do, why they draw feet really thick like the Hulk all the time. Was it about their style? Like, how do they arrive to that? And I feel like that would have been really cool to have too. But now, I mean, now I'm just, you know, kind of shooting for the moon.
I'm just like sort of randomly clicking artists, and I'm starting to see what you mean. Like, there's occasionally like some artists that are very anatomy oriented, very detail oriented. Mm-hmm. And I guess everyone's drawing anatomy to some extent, but there's a lot of cartoony, non-realistic anatomy in a lot of these artists.
That actually brings me to a point that I forgot to mention, which was that a lot of the women in this book are porn stars. Like, it is stick thin, great big cantaloupe boobs that are 4 inches apart and don't look anything or sit anything like real breasts. It kind of hey, you're in the Masters of Anatomy. That's awesome. Have you ever seen a naked lady? Like, just, you know, like, someone that's not had a boob job. It really was, that part of the book was sad for me. Like, I was like, no, this is not, especially if it's going to be used by young artists, like, this is not what we want people to say. Hey, this is normal. This is what I should draw women like. Like, no. Now, I mean, all of them are, both men and women are fit and trim. I haven't really come across that I recall any guys that were really heavy. There were some stockier people, but I hesitate to say that it's whether it's someone's style or whether it's just someone's, you know, choice to, like, you know, draw someone that looks sort of like a dwarf. And I mean like a Hobbit, Lord of the Rings dwarf,
right,
in terms of the proportions, so that the women then just look like really thick guys, but with long hair and boobs. Like, you know, like, there really wasn't that kind of, you know, difference in there. And there could be a lot more going on. Like, well, for example, like, I know that World of Warcraft just redid a lot of their models, and there's a very distinct difference between the male and female dwarves in that game. They're still, you know, shoulders and thighs and hips and boobs and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's done in a way that still makes them look like a dwarf, but still makes them look like a woman too. In several cases in this book, they just failed. You know, again, and that is going to be on the artist. I'm going to say, like, that's a choice made by the artist.
That's a choice made by the artist, but it's also a clarity. Again, I think it's like the director is some fault here. You know what I mean?
Yes.
The editor in this case.
Like, oh yeah, no, I'm not, like, not excusing them.
How are you
them, yeah.
telling your artist what you're actually looking for? How are you expressing your vision? Mm-hmm. And it sounds like the vision that they expressed to the artist, and then the vision that they expressed to the Kickstarter community, and the what came out in the end are not all matched up.
No, and I think what it looks like to me is that they basically said, "Hey, we'll pay you to do this." People with busy schedules did it the once, and there was no revisions. Like,
right.
I don't really feel like they sent anything back and said,
"Well, it's all sketches, right?"
Yeah, like, it just, and they should have. Like, there should have been a couple where just like, "Yeah, there's no, that's not exactly what we meant." You know, and quite often something else that kind of that shows kind of a skew in the book too is that the guys are often drawn better than the women. Like, there's a lot of stronger grasp of male anatomy in the book than there is of female anatomy.
Because only men have muscles.
Yeah. Well, and it's not necessarily just muscles. It was more just, right, like, you know, how the body goes together, proportions, stuff like,
right,
that. But anyway, we should probably move on as what was going to be a short rant turned into something a lot longer.
We have a tendency to do that, you and I.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's get into the internet minute and wrap things up. You found something just before the show that I thought sounded quite intriguing, and I have absolutely zero idea what it is. So you can get to that right after I tell everybody about our sponsor, that is Tweaked Audio. You can go to tweakedaudio.com for high-performance noise-reducing earbuds and enter the code TCC at checkout for free shipping and 30% off your entire order. That's tweakedaudio.com, and the code is TCC. So, John, tell everybody about Micro HoloLens.
So this literally, I think this was announced today. Microsoft has come out with a an augmented reality visor, I guess is the best way to say it. There's a link to the video in the show notes, and it shows basically like computing. Think Google Glass, except it's just, you know, everywhere. It's kind of like blurring the lines of, you know, your everything can be your screen.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's like they show a shot of somebody playing Minecraft in their living room, a la like Legos, like on the table, there's a building on the floor. There's like this castle and like these, you know, like they, it's like everything is, you know, becomes a surface for, you know, for what essentially looked like Minecraft. You know, they had like, okay, you know, you're looking at the wall and there's a TV screen on the wall, except it's actually, you know, in this visor. And then you can like, you know, they stretch it and stuff like that. So it's like, it's this sort of weird computing experience. I think the thing that is the most interesting, at least interesting for consumers, but I think the most viable use for this type of product is they showed like, you know, like essentially like 3D printing stuff and doing like CAD, except they're like, okay, here's this motorcycle. You know, I had this idea for the fuselage, and then there's the rest of the 3D augmented on top of what they've built in real life. And then there's playing and stretching it and stuff like that. So it's weird. It's interesting. And immediately every news article that you'll read about this is cool, but remember the Kinect?
Yeah.
And so it's like, yeah, what will this really end up looking like? And Microsoft does not have a very good track record of coming out, like actually successfully pushing technology forward. They make some interesting experiments, but as far as pushing things like this into the mainstream, Kinect has failed at this point. Now they've done some really cool stuff. I mean, Kinect was the best thing. The best reason to have a Kinect was to plug it into your computer and start coding stuff for it and doing weird, crazy stuff with it. It was not particularly useful for the average consumer. And I have a feeling that this will end up being not good enough to pull off the vision that they have.
Yeah. And I mean, it looks really fancy, but I mean, it's essentially the same as any kind of commercial that you see for this kind of stuff, is that it's all CG. It's not, can't really, you know, I'd be curious to see when they can get to the point where they can put a camera kind of like on someone's forehead or, you know, have a couple of cameras where people's eyes are and then really kind of get a filmed experience. Like, this is what this person is seeing. You know,
right.
And be able to communicate that to you in a video. Like, there's a lot of things. I've seen a lot of tech news people say, like, look, you just can't understand Google Glass until you wear a pair, you know, and
right. I mean, I think that's the same thing with, Oculus Rift and things like, they are an experience that has to be experienced hands-on. There's no way to replicate it unless you had the experience, in which case you're having the experience.
Yeah. This seems like a really cool idea. Like, I mean, for the proof of concept, sure. Really, for this thing to do gangbusters, all it really has to do is play Minecraft well. If they can do that one thing,
yeah,
then they're golden, right? Like, they don't have to even
people
think
would
about
buy it.
It
just as a Minecraft machine. And it looks, I think the most interesting thing about it is that it's completely self-contained. It doesn't connect to a phone, it's not connected to the internet, it is completely self-contained. There's no, like, and that's I'm skeptical of that. That's impressive, you know, but I get, you know, that's their goal, is like, you just put on this headset and I don't know how it would connect. Maybe it's wirelessly connect to a computer as far as like doing displays and stuff like that. I mean,
it connects to Netflix, right? I mean, it has to be able to connect to the internet somehow. And then you're just like, all right, well, hey, this is what it looks like theoretically on your, you know, 20 gigabit, you know, or 20 gigabit, you know, internet speed.
Right.
You know, if you're getting top tier, like, I mean, then, but if you're not, like, if you're just, if you're like the rest of us that are downloading, you know, like, you know, 80K a second, then, like, this isn't going to work.
And how much are these things going to cost? And then it's like, okay, so it's great, it's a TV, but, like, if my wife and I want to watch the same thing, and I'm like, that'd be cool, like, hey, I just have a blank wall. Let's just, or it doesn't even matter, it doesn't even have to be a blank wall. We can just put it literally, you know, in front of us, floating in midair, you know, whatever. But do we, how are we both going to see the same thing? And like, you know, I feel like this is one of those things, again, the problem with all of this, these technologies and VR and everything is shared experiences. And everything seems to, you know, it all starts to break down. You know, they're all focusing on, you know, they're focusing on the hurdle of, what does Oculus Rift put it? Presence, I believe they talk about. And that's their biggest hurdle, you know, tricking the brain into really thinking you're there and things like that. But, you know, as soon as you have other stimuli outside of that, things start to get weird. And it's like, you know, I'm just wondering how I'll be interested to see how they deal with multiple users and things like that. Because if this is a one-off thing I'm going to use as my computer sort of thing, and it's a personal thing, it's interesting, but I don't see myself ever spending money on it.
Yeah, I mean, I can sort of see, like, if they had them linked up, like if you and your wife were both playing Minecraft together, just because that's the example you've been using, and you were on one side of the thing that you've built, and she was on the other, and you were both looking at the same thing but from different views, because the device would know where you're standing in relation to the display that's showing you, that would be pretty cool.
It would be amazing.
You know, like, then you're talking about, like, I mean, think about how that would change tabletop Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this would be brilliant for tabletop games.
Yeah.
I mean, like, just having, okay, here the table is the map, and I can move the map. I can just shift it around.
Yeah.
And essentially the table becomes a giant touchscreen. I would absolutely love that. I mean, I can't imagine the coding that it would take to, you know, like, you know, okay, great, they've got this technology, but then how do developers then use this technology and make, you know, how much of a pain in the butt is it going to make decent experiences with this technology?
Yeah. Halifax Ginger in the chat room mentioned that it would be really cool for multiplayer split screen games, which I think would be really neat too.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of, so they're doing that with like 3D, and I think the PS4 has it, if I'm not mistaken, where you know, with the, like the 3D glasses, I forget if it's the frame flipping ones or whatever, but they can show different things to different people.
Right. Yeah. You're seeing one frame rate. Like, it's basically the televisions are fast enough now that they can show double the frame rate. So that you put the glasses on,
20 frames,
you put the glasses on and you see only the frames that are meant for you, and then your buddy sees the ones that are meant for him, and therefore you can both play it at full screen.
Yeah, yeah. That's brilliant. I mean, being able to do, you know, couch co-op on one machine and have a full screen and not see the other person's, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Anything that can go to that. This seems like a lot for, this is like a huge potential, but really, is it going to do any one thing very well enough to make it a sales? And I think you might be right. And I think I've even met in the headlines of news articles for these. You know, it's like it's if it's a Minecraft machine, it might actually work.
Yeah, well, and I think you, I mean, you mentioned it too. Like, I mean, I said D&D, but anything tabletop. If they can really get into that market, then those that will want to learn how to make it really useful will do so, but those that are content to just use it as a novelty will totally enjoy it. Like, just, I mean, you're talking about the holographic chess game from Star Wars, all right? I mean, like, that would be cool enough that I think a lot of people would be interested in this if it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my
bring
pick this,
it on, Microsoft.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. So my pick this week is actually another Kickstarter that I mentioned. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier today or not. I might have tweeted about it. It has doubled since last time I checked, which was this morning. And that is Exploding Kittens. It is a new tabletop card game from a bunch of people. Elon Lee Xbox and ARGS. Matthew Inman, of course, that everybody knows from The Oatmeal, and Shane Small of Xbox and Marvel. The video on the Kickstarter is concise and simple, you can go ahead and get the game explained to you by watching the video. It's very, very cool. I can't believe that it has basically gone to 2.3 million with still
2.4 now.
30. Is it 2.4 already?
Yeah.
Wow. With still 29 days to go. Let me refresh the page. I've had this tab open. Yeah. 2.4. I've had this page open. So it's gone from 2,323,000 to now 414,000 in the course of this episode of the show. Cause I opened this before we started.
I love their graphic under about this project. The first thing you see is 100% funded in 20 minutes, 1,000% funded in less than an hour.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Just insane. And something that I have to give them props for is that there are no stretch goals. There are no...
Good for them.
Yeah, there's no extras. You can pick the kind of pledge level you want, and it's basically just like the difference between a kid-friendly deck, an adult deck, more than one deck, or a collector deck, or I can't exactly remember what. I think you just get everything all in one package.
Yeah, you have the kids, adults, then you get two decks, one signed, and then a custom card drawn by a creator.
Yeah, and they're just like, they're keeping it simple, which, I mean, yeah, they have to. I mean, they would be...
I hate a complicated Kickstarters.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, like ridiculous amounts of, I mean, you know, like Star Citizen I bought into like, I don't know, 2 years ago. And the things, I don't know, I really, it's too big to fail at this point. It is the Kickstarter whale.
Yeah.
But, you know, it gets so complicated, and it just becomes like this free to play thing that's not even, you can't even play yet. Like, you're going to pay for all these little extra doodads. I'm like,
yeah,
how much money are you actually putting into the product? Are you just paying for all these crap things that I, you know,
yeah, that you don't need, or the, you know, Kickstarter exclusive and stuff like that. And so I appreciate the simplicity of it. I don't know. I have a weird feeling about Kickstarters like this that go crazy in the first, you know, couple minutes and end up going into the millions of dollars. And I mean, hey, great. They came up with, it sounds like a fun game to play. Mm-hmm.
One can overly invest. You know what I mean?
No.
Like, well, all right. There's people are investing for a custom drawing, or they're investing for a signed, you know, thing. Fine. They're going to sign some things, but
yeah,
you know, like, but they even limited those. They had, what, $500 or more? Five backers only they limited it to.
Yeah.
200 backers for the $100 or more. And then the other two, you know, the other ones are unlimited. So it's like, that makes sense. Like, if somebody really, really wants to help get this off the ground, let them pay some money. But don't go crazy with it.
Yeah.
And everyone else, most of that money is people who just want to buy the game based off of what they saw.
Yeah. And I mean, the $500 and the $100 that capped it, didn't it? That, so 200, 100, yeah. So the $500 backers, that was 25% of their original goal. And then the 200 backers at 100 or more, that if those all went, that they double funded.
Right,
and then everybody else is just coming in, as...
and so that's 20,000 out of 2.4 million. So, like,
yeah, by 205 people.
Yeah,
yeah.
So we actually, we're up to 2.416. So you could pretty much say just about 2.4 million just people just bought the game flat out.
Yeah.
Based off of that video and assumedly the people who are in it, but I'm happy.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Inman, Matthew Inman, the guy that writes and draws the Oatmeal blog, has a stupid amount of people following him.
And this is what it goes like. Kickstarter works really well if you have a following. If you have a built-in, way to get people to go to that, and people who are willing to. You know, building audience is the most lucrative and difficult things you can do.
Yeah. I I'm not a huge fan of the oatmeal, so I mean, some of the humor in the game is not really my cup of tea. I've got lots of friends that I follow on Kickstarter that have already backed it, so it's obviously appealing to a lot of folks out there.
Mm-hmm.
Not just strangers, but like people that I know and are obviously looking forward to it. I mean,
it's a bit on the high side. Like if I'm just looking at price of a deck, a simple card game, I feel like should be 10, 15 bucks.
Yeah.
35 bucks is,
a
bit high. I think $20 should be on the high end. So and I get that, if I were really into it, then I would buy it. But it is a little bit on the expensive side for what it is.
Yeah. You're in the US, you get it shipped to you for free. I would not. So anything that I haven't backed it, so I don't know what it's going to cost to ship this little deck of cards to Canada.
Right.
But I'm assuming probably a lot more than $35. I'm probably looking at, if I decided to get it, it's probably $50 by the time it's all said and done. Hey, and then there's the exchange, and we don't even really need to go into that this second. But the basics of the game is just basically, four people sit around and pull cards from the deck. And if you pull the exploding kitten, you die unless you've got cards in your hand that allow you to defuse the exploding kitten.
So it's some weird sort of game of hot potato?
Yeah. And they explain it precisely as that in the video. As a hot potato, like a weird hot potato game. It's simple, works. With these tabletop games, you don't want to have to spend 20 minutes learning how to play it, right? You want to just sit down with, four friends and just give her.
That's why Flux has done so freaking well.
Yeah.
That's, here's a simple formula and let's go crazy around that formula.
Yeah. Well, I hope that, I'm curious to see how it continues, whether it plateaus or continues to just go completely nuts. Do you know what the largest Kickstarter ever is?
Kickstarter, not sure. The game that I mentioned, Star Citizen, is the largest. They're at 70 million.
What?
Yep.
Wow.
Now that's not Kickstarter. That is they did a Kickstarter. They did a couple of things and now they're fully on their own, but it's completely crowdfunded.
Okay.
And people are essentially buying, you're buying digital stuff, it's from the creator of Wing Commander.
Okay.
Space simulator games.
Yes. And, I remember, I've heard about this now. I forgot the name of it, but yeah, we were buying and building a ship.
Yeah. So basically people are paying, and I paid the base price for the game and more money to have the ship that I really wanted. And, I really wanted that space freighter that I could, get my friends in and fly around together. I mean, it's selling me on a vision, and it's a vision that I cannot wait for. And again, that's a whole shared experience thing. Games are starting to get more into these, EVE Online, where things organically, stories are created by people.
Yeah.
And the systems that are in this game just make way for weird shit to happen between people. And I think that's really cool. But most of the games that are like that, like Minecraft and things like that, the gameplay itself is not particularly enthralling to me.
Yeah.
And this, the idea, I've always loved space games and space flight sims, but to be able to go out and just do whatever I want with my friends and have them in my ship, and then I can get out of my ship and go on with, the promises that they're selling here are really high, but they're actually doing them. And it, like I said, it's too big to fail at this point. They are constantly getting feedback. They're constantly getting more money. They anticipate being over $100 million by the end of, over this next year.
Wow.
It's nuts.
I'm going to have to look into that a little bit more. I mean, I heard, I guess, murmurs or people talk about it on probably podcasts that you and I both listen to back when it first came out, and they're just kind of speculating about announcement details and stuff like that. Probably E3, probably in 2013, maybe whenever they made a big deal about it.
Yeah.
I'm always curious about that kind of stuff. I mean, I haven't had a video game really grab me in a long time. Long time.
Yeah. I keep looking for it. I'm like, where's that game? The unicorn,
Yeah.
Where's my unicorn? And I have so, my problem is A, it has to be with something that I can play with three other friends. And the three friends, which includes my wife, have very particular things that they want out of it and stuff like that. Nothing, you know, it's like we're all pining for the good old days and nothing quite gives us what we want, what we got, like what we got out of World of Warcraft back, you know, like 4, 5, 6 years ago. You know, nothing is providing that spark anymore. There's things that are doing it to some extent in some degrees, but there's always like, it's just never quite up my alley. So I'm crossing my fingers for this one. This one at least will be, you know, probably my wife wouldn't play this, but I just like the idea of, you know, me and my friend plotting a course and, you know, trucking stuff around the universe. And even if it's like, we will have fun, even if it's just us moving cargo.
Yeah. And, yeah. The one that I'm looking forward to is No Man's Sky.
Yeah. Similar, you know, much more, just pure exploration and very, like, it sounds like they're putting it like it's unlikely that you'll run into other people. Like, it's very, like, very slim. Well, you'll run into people, but you won't run into many.
Yeah.
It's so freaking huge.
So freaking huge. Yeah. I mean, again, and that's something else that is promising, well, the universe. And then you're kind of, you know, you kind of wonder what the logistics are in delivering that.
Mm.
But, well, that wraps up another gigantic episode of the Citadel Cafe.
You asked for it.
I did. And I like having gigantic episodes every once in a while. It's a lot of fun. We record live every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on the CitadelCafe.com/live. Our mobile audio stream is provided by AlphaGeekRadio.com. You can listen to the show live on Alpha Geek Radio on your computer or your favorite mobile browser at mobile.alphageekradio.com. Just tune into channel 1 at showtime. Music for the show was composed by Kevin MacLeod, and the episode will, of course, be available on demand via iTunes and our website, thecitadelcafe.com, which is also where you can find the show notes from this episode. Hopefully, I will be able to remember all of the things that John and I talked about and get as many of those links to you guys as possible. Email the show at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com or find us by name on Twitter and Facebook. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find me every Wednesday at the Dalhousie Student Union Farmers Market. You can also find me at joelduggan.com and visit my Patreon page, patreon.com/joelduggan. That is where you can support this very show as well as my comic work for as little as a dollar a month. You can also follow me on Twitter and Tumblr with just my name, Joel Duggan. John, where can people find you online?
You can follow me on Twitter at Copper Dome, probably the most reasonable place to go.
You've been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two. Just don't pick Microsoft.
You know, I probably wouldn't talk so damn much if I did a show more often.
Thanks for hanging out, Halifax Ginger, and Hammond has just joined the chat room, too.
Too late. We're not doing it again.
That's it. YouTube, Blarg. I'm not sure who Blarg is, but you've been there the entire show, silent. So, welcome.
Who says Blarg? Who is that?
Blarg.
Blarg.
Oh, I forgot to mention Molly on the show. TCC fan is usually a regular in our chat room, and she emailed me today to say that she's probably not going to be around for a while because she's going off to boot camp.
Wow.
She has joined the American forces. For those of you tuning in on Alpha Geek, this is how the sausage is made 3 seconds before the show starts.
Don't talk about my sausage.